Philosophy 58, February 23rd, 1954.
Variants don't know that much about culture.
And one more correction in this report, gentlemen, important in your notes. Don't say that the Chinese are a people. They aren't a people to this day. The people in Canton cannot understand the people in the north, that they are an empire. And that's geographical. That's a unity in space. They have a wall around themselves. You don't know this, but there are still many tribes and many peoples in China. So don't call the Chinese so simply, you see, a people in our specific sense of heading towards the future. You see, if you go went to China in 1800 or in 1700 as the Jesuits did, there was no expectation of any future in China. Just the cycle, you see, of eternal recurrence, of return. That's typical of the empire. So you should say, call China an empire. It's quite important to make this distinction, you see. Because never has there been any messianic, you see, prophecy. And I think already now you may begin to understand that these words cannot be bandied around arbitrarily. I had a friend who was a Harvard graduate. He just was in process of graduating in June. Of his graduating year, he came up to my place. And he said, in Harvard, I have been taught one thing in political science. There is no such thing as people. They are just individuals. And he grew up with a healthy contempt of the sophisticated people in Harvard, that people was a sentimental fiction, you see, of the old-timers in this country who still believed that there was a people of the United States. Certainly, that was the time when Harvard had no future. And on the other hand, I forced this boy who wanted to learn something to stay with me. When he entered the house, I said, I'm going to talk to you, but only if you stay 3 days and two nights. I'm not going to give you an interview, as he wanted to have. I said, but the curse of our time is that people do not know the quality of time. If you want to learn something in a new environment, the minimum today, as things stand in this country, is 2 days and three nights. And we have never allowed any visitor from the cities to come up to our house for a shorter stay. Because it's a fact that men are so space-minded that they can drive to seven places in one day in their car, you see? Fall upon these innocent inhabitants of these seven houses, have a cocktail or lunch and drive on and then say they have seen seven people. They haven't, you see. They have not. They have the illusion that they have met these seven people. They know nothing about this. That's how you travel through Europe. A great harm is done because you come back and say you have been to Europe. You have not been to Europe. You have carried all your blindness, your illusions, your prejudices into Europe and come back with the same. Like the boy who went through 16 countries in 6 weeks in Europe and then got quarreling with his comrade on the boat home because he said, yes, we have been to Austria. And the other said, no, we have not been to Austria. So he said, yes. Well, how can you prove it, said the other boy. In Austria, the porter had a blue cap. So that was Austria. Now I'm quite serious, gentlemen. I tried to sell you this proposition that time is of the essence today. That people who do not know how to time their lives are licked. They have a neurosis. They have a syndrome. They will break down. They will go to Brattleboro. And you see, the lack of understanding of the time problem goes to such small things as your visits with other people or visit of other countries. You have no friends, you have just roommates, you are chummy, you are nice to everybody. Do you have friends, gentlemen? In order to have friends, you have to give them time. And as I said, I would say this is not a mere experience. A rule of thumb, a very queer one, that before I will talk Turkey to a man I must have his time for 2 nights and 3 days in the same place with me. And before, it's no use talking. Because I must first talk to him, then he must be allowed to get in, up his opposition. The second day must be a complete failure. We must discover how far we have misunderstood each other, and we of course have totally misunderstood each other, you see. And so on the third day, we may then draw the synthesis and we may come to some agreement. That's why sermons are no good today, because the minister usually feels obliged to preach one sermon. So the whole sermon is one big misunderstanding. The Archbishop of Canterbury came 20 years ago to this country and said, out must the sermons go. It's taught, misunderstood. Things come over the radio now in editorials and in magazine articles. So the church must always offer the opposite. So he told the people at Harvard Divinity School, begin to preach long sequences. Never preach a sermon that lasts less than 6 weeks. And that's very serious, gentlemen. For 20 years, I have never given a single lecture in this country. Although this is the country of the single lecture, I certainly could have earned $1 million. I don't give single lectures. Because in a single lecture, I can only just begin to learn how this man who listens to me uses a different vocabulary and everything is different with him. You see it from this case here with China. You said it doesn't matter to say, call this, you see, a people. It matters very much. Because the Chinese just aren't a people as we think of them in the West, you see. So we can't treat them well. They want to become a people now, you see. That's why they need some tremendous promise like communism. It doesn't matter what the promise is, but at least communism has a long-range future, you see. So this hasn't happened for 4,000 years in China. And so, if Christianity still had the coming of Christ, you see, the coming of the Lord in its gospel, our missionaries would have kept China in the Christian fold, and they tried it seriously. But unfortunately, our ministers, our missionaries, were all told at home that they should become doctors and teachers instead. So we did. And there was no gospel preached, you see, but just schools and education, which you think is wonderful. But gentlemen, no country can live on education, because education has no future. Future is for the adults. Future is a promise what's this country heading for. Who cares what you are heading for? You are heading for a career. But the career must be inside of some body politics that moves forward, that has a mission, that has a destiny. Now, 100 years ago, everybody in this country had manifest destiny, you see. So 100 years ago, Japan and China took our gospel, you see, because they felt we were going places. But the last 50 years, we abdicated ourselves. We said, we'll give you science. Well, science has no future. Science is a technicality. You can't live by science. If you are scientific, you better not marry, because you may make a mistake, you see. You better not write poetry, because there's no money in it. If you have science, you are licked. You are inside the present only. The useful things of today, you can know what to do by science. Can you ever create a new conscience by science? Can you ever create a new hope? You can't. So this is very serious, this little distinction, because I'm very determined to stand my ground in telling you that I and you are invited to embark on this watershed, on this great divide between 1,000 years of mere space consciousness in the West, you see, and suddenly awakening up to the great mysteries of time. If you would not laugh, but take seriously my proposition that human beings today cannot meet really in a shorter time than 2 days and 3 nights. It's 3 nights and 2 days. Oh, how is it? 2 nights and 3 days. It's a minimum, really. It should be longer. Then you understand the weekend. Why, instead of the Sunday of our ancestors, the weekend is now the sanctuary of the human soul? Because then you have 2 nights and 3 days, you see. Because people feel that such a weekend is already worthwhile, whereas the Sunday would be too short. You see, nothing could happen. As you know, in California, they go out for
every fortnight the employees of the stores into the mountains or wherever they want to go from Thursday evening to Monday. Because it is so preeminent, the need to have one coherent span of time. So they are away from Thursday night to Sunday, and they work the other weekend, which is better, you see, than to have each time such a fragment of hours. Can you understand? This is all in the center of everybody's life today, and it is also central in the life of the nations. So now I am in a position to put before you our program. No. You have the fate of the tribes, of the empires, of the Greeks, of Israel, and you have church, state, or let us call it the world of states, and the great society. And I tell you once more, here, quite modestly and humbly, we can say that we stand here. We have seen how the world was filled with states. We have seen how the church entered the world. We have yet to see how society will organize work all over the world, in all men, in all tribes, in all the whole family of mankind. So this we do not know yet, but we are waiting for. And these two things, how the Jews were replaced by the church, the old Israel by the new, and how the world became one world of civilized states, we have this in our bones. This has happened. And before now entering into this first chapter, let's make it 7 chapters. We will now add one more distinction between antiquity and our own era. There were innumerable tribes. 100,000 is the low guess. And 100,000 languages. There were at least 30 different empires. That's going by the score, so to speak, not by the 100,000s. And then there has been the philosophy and the poetry or the art of the Greeks, and there has been the prayer of the Bible, people of the Bible of Israel. Now in all these four cases, gentlemen, every member of the group was encased and imprisoned totally into its own ruin. If you were a Greek, you couldn't be a barbarian. If you were a Sioux, you couldn't become an Apache without, there were some ceremonies that were very difficult. If you go into the history of this continent, you can see that the Indians were quite incapable of becoming civilized. It hasn't worked. Our attempts, you see, to civilize these people, to make them into city dwellers, was impossible. Once red Indian, always red Indian. And you know how sick they are now in their souls, because they are slickers, so to speak. The government supports them on the worst possible land, which we have been good enough to leave these poor people, you see, and they can't live and they can't die. It's a really very pitiful sight, because they are still ancient people. I had a friend among the Indians, a chieftain, who said to me that he managed to make his whole tribe turn Lutheran, because he said it was the only way, Christianity, of making these tribes able, his tribe, able to change into a new era, to give up the rituals, the charms, you see, the magic, the dances, but at least be free again to be people like you and me. Very serious and very fine men, and he himself became the first minister of the church inside this whole tribe. the Stockbridge Indians who now live out in, I think, in Wisconsin. This is very serious. Fix this down, gentlemen. In antiquity, every man was only one thing and not no other. There are to this day in the Empire of China tribesmen who are strictly tribal, who have never settled, who do not recognize agriculture or private property of land. They cannot be absorbed by the Chinese. The empire has proved incapable of mending the ways of these nomads who live inside, so to speak, the wall of China, you see, but have their own hunting grounds and their own free movements still there. Antiquity, gentlemen, was unable to change a tribesman into an empire builder, or an empire man into a Greek, or a Greek into a Jew, or a Jew into a Greek, at least not in large numbers. It was felony, it was high treason, it was desertion if you did go over. Individual cases have happened, but people were always very unhappy in such cases. If you go to Egypt, to this day there are 40,000 Bedouins, desert dwellers, who have not taken on to the ways of the Egyptians ever. And to this day they represent in the valley of the Nile an element that is pre-Egyptian, that is pre-Pharaonic, that have, they have the same ways of life as the Arabian nomads have in the peninsula of Arabia, and they go back really to the first awakening of men's political urge 7,000 years back, that is a considerable time before the first pharaoh of Egypt built his first pyramid. If you are encased, imprisoned, but also molded and formed by one order of things only, gentlemen, then you are very much a whole man. There is nothing that yearns beyond it. In America, any man has enough received of Christianity to sympathize with something out of America. You sympathize with Raphael. You sympathize with the English Parliament or English tennis playing, with Wimbledon. You sympathize, anyone in this country has some lasting interest either in the country from which he came, you see, or into the country to which he wants to get, you see, some connections for travel. We all are not simply Americans. It is a distinction of an American to have the right to love non-Americans, to admire them, and to know them. This was not the case with the ancients. The ancient group is self-centered, and therefore it is intense. Take a family relation between a son and his parents in antiquity. That is so total that parents had the right to slaughter their children as sacrifices. Agamemnon did this to his daughter when he wanted to show his Greeks that he meant business with the Trojan War. As you know, he was asked to give up the life of his daughter, and she thought that was quite all right. There was never a doubt in his daughter's mind that her father had this right over her. If it was necessary for the world or commonwealth, then she, the victim, went to its death in great dignity, just as Isaac also did not object when his father first thought he had to do the same and slaughter his son. We today, gentlemen, every one of us lives in at least two orders, church and state. Even you have heard of the alleged freedom of the church in this country from the state, which means that you contain both, which most people never think of. Even the atheist in this country can occupy with his own ego this second realm of freedom which otherwise is given to you as a member of a church. If the church is free, it also means that everyone has inside of him some province, some territory which is not state, that is, which is not worldly.
he may make no use of it. You may say, to me this is a pipe dream. But others are allowed to realize this pipe dream, you see. So the man in this country who is not interested in the church is still benefiting from the church by being given a tremendous amount of leeway about his thought, about his speech, about his readings, about his way of studies, because the church and the state cut two different territories out of your heart, which you most of you never think of. When I hear here people today repeat this formula, church and state, or free church and free state, or whatever you have passed on as a slogan, I always find that you are completely dead to the great statement involved in this, that you are state and church when you say this. The whole sentence, church and state, you see, makes no sense whatsoever unless you recognize that you are at the same time in the church and in the state, and that they are kept apart. Most of you will admit, speak of state and church something here and there, but it is. There is nowhere in America can you find any place which is only church, because the building of the church stands within the territory of the United States of America and is protected by the military might of this country, isn't it not? You can look everywhere, gentlemen. Church and state are not divided visibly. They are divided inside of every member of this great Commonwealth of the United States of America. We will see that is true of society too. The society is another such thing of first magnitude, which is in every one of us as far as we must work, as far as we are unemployed. We don't care who gives us work. I work for a Cuban. So, gentlemen, these three seemingly superficial statements, church fills the first 1,000 years, state fills the second 1,000 years of the world of states, and instead of empires, the replacement of empires, you can also call the second chapter by states, and society, these three things have been planted into you and me, and nowhere else. You look at the world occasionally as a world of states. You look occasionally at it as a world of souls, as a world of one people with a common destiny, that's the church. And you look at it as a tremendous division of labor, and then you include the oil in Arabia, although we have very little to do with Ibn Saud, and you include it, you see, the uranium mines in the mountains of the eastern part of Germany, where the eastern Germans now are allowed to slave for the Russians. Because society is the whole order of men having to go up from non-working to working, to non-working again, from earning a living, from changing their place, from finding occupation and activity from one day to another in constant change. If you see this, gentlemen, then our era is hampered and imperiled by one simple factor, by pluralism. Every one of us is half a patriot and half a Christian and half a career man, a worker, a job hunter, one third of it. So we are divided in our loyalties. And divided loyalty makes people weak. And the Christian era has accepted this weakness in honor and humility for the power of growth. If you are very strong, you are fixed. You are in a rut, as we say today. Whenever an American man says, I'm getting into a rut, he blames himself. Isn't that true? But that only means he's only one thing and not also another. So this slogan, you see, he was getting into a rut, high time for him to get out, means that he acknowledged it is better to be pluralistic than to be one-sided. Now the ancients would have thought that was terrible. Once a baker, always a baker. Once a peasant, always a peasant. Once anything got you completely and swallowed you up. And therefore, gentlemen, there is a very wonderful division of labor between the ancient and our era. Any inhabitant of this great era of ours for the last 1954 years has had to be educated in the intensity, in the singleness of purpose by learning about the ancients. The Christians had to learn the Old Testament in order to get the full jealousy of the God of Israel into their bones. Because if the brotherhood of man is preached only, they would all have become already 100 years ago so lackadaisical as you are. You don't care for any creed, you say everybody is all right. Gentlemen, that's nonsense. It is not true that all people are equally right. Therefore is China when communistic, you see. That's the whole reason. Because we are very willing to say, we don't know, we are no better, we don't know better, Christianity is not better than Confucianism. But the Chinese said, it isn't true, Confucianism is not as good as Christianity because these Western devils come to us. They have done something and we haven't. So now they go communistic. It's a competition between two Western offers of a future, which are now, you see, spreading out over China. This is very serious for your understanding of the problem of China. The Chinese don't care for communism, but they care very much for the intensity of belief into something real to come. And therefore they put up with the low standard of living and they laugh at us who sell out the future for the high standard of living. They say the Americans have no future. That's why they must have bastards. The bathtub has no future then. What is the future, gentlemen? That for which it is right to sacrifice the present. If a soldier in Korea dies, he does it for the future of the United States. And you know how hard it was for these people out there to understand this, because the people at home just don't understand it. They don't believe in the future at home. How can these boys out there believe in it? This is the future, gentlemen. There is no other future except that future which is able to make a man give up his present benefits. Any girl doesn't who gets engaged with you. She always gives up a nice life, you see, for a very uncertain future. Otherwise, she couldn't get married. But you see, the word sacrifice has been eliminated out of your thinking, out of the teaching in this country, out of the public discussion. The word sacrifice has been tabooed. And gentlemen, that's why we have lost all sense of timing. Future and present are not connected automatically, they are only connected through sacrifice. Anyone who takes at this moment less than he earns, than he could ask for, creates a future. Anybody who tries to get something for nothing thrusts the whole country into the past. Any thief who takes a golden watch, what does he do? He forces us to waste money on a police force. Decent people would do with the least police force, you see, because they have to think so much of restoring the order already installed in the past. But what do we do? All the interest centers around all these miserable juvenile delinquents. They are not interested. They keep us back, they drain our resources, they chain us to things and orders which we already know, you see, as having been established. Every delinquent, every criminal is an accusation against our educational system, these children. They have been brought upright into the order. Nobody has told them to obey. So they don't. But yesterday I heard a tremendous case, very interesting. The chief of police in a little midwestern town had this very successful father, and he had wanted to rebel, and so he committed armed robbery. He got 15 years in prison.
and the doctor, a psychiatrist in the prison saw this case. He got him out by pleading a neurosis, by saying this boy just had to enact this crime in order to get even with his father. See, since the father happened to be a chief of police, he had to be the chief of the gangster, of the robbers. But what does this mean? That all this family, the prison, the law, the judiciary, this psychiatrist, who happened to be my own son, that they all were chained back to something that everybody knew how it should be, you see, done, and that they all plunged into dealing with the backwash of life. And that's the terrible thing about criminal justice, gentlemen, that it delays life, that it takes every one of you back into something settled 2,000 years ago, because that you can't have armed robbery. That really was settled 2,000 years ago, more or less, wasn't it? This is so uninteresting. All these, these are the headlines of your papers, gentlemen. This country is so afraid of the future that the headlines are only dealing with the wantonly conduct of past. This is the term, gentlemen, wantonly conduct of past. It is wanton what these news health press does to you, to your brains and your hearts. Absolute unnecessary. You're filling yourself with the filth and the scum of the of life. Nobody knows for what purpose. Oh, I know, because the newspaper says. Now, gentlemen, because there is in any time this lack of stamina, this lack of certainty of what is to do, that you say, oh, I don't know. How? It's too difficult. As one of you
burst forth, I respected this very much, I understand it. Wasn't the other cause, and he said, well, we just, it's too confusing. You just want to be left alone. So, the individual in this world at this moment, gentlemen, is easily excused for not knowing what is the central thing to do. But you must understand that history is a means to include this continent if we are not to be left behind, which is still very possible. That it must make an appeal to you so that you give your whole heart and soul, as the old saying is, all your soul, all your heart, and all your power to that which is necessary next. That's usually the voice of the divine life. That's why it is said, your neighbor you can love as yourself. That's good enough. But God you must love with all your power. Now give me one man in this country who knows what this sentence means. They always quote only the neighborly love. And since I don't love myself so very much, so I don't have to love my neighbor very much. I don't have to love him more than myself, you see. I hate myself, so I hate my neighbor. There are many people who hate themselves. But this is not true with their relation to your maker. He wants to make the world. And if you do not do his bidding totally, it can't be done. Creation, gentlemen, is not happening with hypocrisy or with a split personality or with schizophrenia. This country consists, as they say, the doctors must know it, 90% of schizophrenics, so creation doesn't happen. Creation is based on your total dedication. And here comes in the mystery of our relation to the ancient peoples, gentlemen. The Christians get their fervor from reading the Psalms of the Old Testament and the history of the patriarchs of Abraham, who had faith when there was no pope in Rome. What's this today, easy to believe in Christianity with all the cardinals and the Vatican and the Bible translations and the theologians, Mr. Tillich and Mr. Niebuhr, preaching the gospel everywhere? But Abraham, he was utterly alone in his faith. If you read the story of Abraham, you know what faith really means. It doesn't mean to recite other people's creeds. So the Old Testament is today still necessary to shoot, to inject into Christianity this total dedication of the single member. The same is true about the empires, gentlemen. What have we done during the last hundreds of years? We have revived Rome. You have learned Cicero. Your aunt, at least you haven't, but your father learned Caesar and Cicero and Horace. Why did they do it? Because this was still an empire with total dedication. When Rome, you see, went despotical and tyrannical, Cato took his life, as you know, the great Cato of Utica, because he didn't want to survive the free citizenry of Rome. Well, that is total dedication. And then your forefathers, for the last 500-600 years, have read avidly the story of the Greeks and the Romans, because they were undivided in their loyalty. And we are divided. And so it's like a refresher course when you read or go to the stage and see Coriolanus enacted as they do now in New York, as you know, by Shakespeare, William Shakespeare, you know. And you see total dedication. And you see the consequences of, and then even trying to break away from Rome. You see, it can't be done. He tries to go over to the enemy. There's no third being, no pluralism, no church to which he can cling. He cannot become a Quaker or Mennonite, Coriolanus. He just can go over to the enemy, which is just another city, you see, trying to swallow him up. Have you, who has read Coriolanus? That all? Who has seen it? I'm sorry. How about Julius Caesar? Who has read it? So, gentlemen, what we call the Renaissance is a permanent problem of our era. In any one moment, any member of our era has to refresh his oneness by being confronted with some ancient way of life. You see this very clearly when you today see how people no longer learn Greek and Latin, but instead they take to prehistory, to anthropology, to ethnology, and to primitive life all over the world. This means simply that it is just as I told you, that while this world of states were developed, people studied empires and the Greek. But now, in preparation of the third millennium, in the preparation of the year 2000, people begin to study avidly the tribes. If you read Margaret Mead or any one of these wise men, then you know that this is today the food of any number of freshmen. I think it is done in a very slipshod manner. People don't know that they are playing there with dynamite. But one day we will wear these masks again of these wild tribes. Just as Hamlet of Shakespeare reenacted the great tragedy after 1,000 years of no tragedy in the West Christian world, you see. So we see today the rise of another chapter of antiquity. And what I'm there now I'm going to try to do in this first chapter of my story will be to conjure up, not wantonly, but necessarily, that which is past. So, you remember that I used this formula just 5 minutes ago. I told you, the newspapers conjure up the past wantonly. Crime and no punishment. And divorce and sex and drunkenness, that is everything that is prehistorical, is conjured up there. But it is conjured up commercially, wantonly, for curiosity's sake, for obscenity's sake, for entertainment. Gentlemen, my task here is very simple. It's an antidote. I try to conjure up before you that which necessarily must be remembered in order to give you the intensity of living again. So that you know that this is nothing is done in the world, even in the next 1,000 years, if you do not find some people of total devotion, of obsession, of dedication. However you call it, most of these words are so terribly worn that one doesn't like to use them. But that doesn't matter. With regard to your own decision, you must find some point in your life where you are without reservation, where you are committal. This business of being non-committal, gentlemen, is way good for 9/10 of your life, as long as you know where you have to be committal. If the 9/10 of your life where you are non-committal, where you play and fool around, get the upper hand, and you don't have the 1/9, you see, where it is worth living, you are the most miserable of creatures. You have lost everything. You have lost yourself. There is no such important thing about self. But you have lost your relation to the meaning of your own existence. You have lost the participation in the march of the spirit through the ages of God in history. That's nothing moral, gentlemen. The most ethical and moral man who never steals and never commits fornication and never gets drunk can be just as imbecile, just as split, just as schizophrenic. The morally good people, gentlemen, are not very interesting in history. The people are interesting who dare to exhibit themselves as they are, without hypocrisy. Because you cannot get going in this strange world without being there with all your deficiencies, you see, for all your worth. Anybody who wants to be appear a little better than he is a misfit. Two days ago, I went to the ordination of a minister near a place nearby, and this was the ideal man for the Public Speakers Bureau. He knew always ahead of time what he was going to say, and he said nothing. And he entertained us with the story of his life for 20 minutes. Once in my life, I still have listened to a man who put himself in his word totally. That was Al Smith of Brooklyn. And when he opened his mouth, he flung himself upon his word so totally that you felt he was in it. And he was quite a different speaker from any other speaker I've heard of, you see, because he was in his word. And you could say, see the weaknesses of the man that made him so strong. That he didn't have no hypocrisy, no curtain, silky or iron for that matter, you see, behind which to hide. He wasn't any better than he was. And he took this daring risk that he says, God sees me anyway, so then since my neighbor sees me, the others can see me too. But you always think God might just be absent, and so the others should be protected against your real being. You see, when Jesus on the cross said, my God, why hast thou forsaken me? He knew that his maker looked into his heart anyway, so why couldn't he also say it, that he was in despair? In this last act, he confessed his tremendous fight against hypocrisy. Because he came all out. You wouldn't have said this. You would have acted the role perfectly to the end, you see, with a bow to the purple, to the public, and said it doesn't hurt. As you all do when something hurts, you have been educated to keep smiling. And then most people who in this country have kept smiling too long, they all end up in the lunatic asylum where they must turn weak for the rest of their lives. Because if you suppress your tears, you see, that's another way of escaping your frankness. Weeping is a part of reality. You are told you must never weep. You end up with this chapter with a story. We had once a Russian movie, as long ago, very years ago. It was on Peter the Great. And he was in love with Catherine, a waitress from a simple tavern, and he had married her, and he's very sick, and she thinks that he's going to die. The man was mayor. She became empress, but that, at that time that was not clear, and she saw herself in despair in this stage play, in this movie, over the body of this ailing czar,
and begins to weep. Unendingly. Well, my eyes were moistened, but the boy is a naked laugh. So I was very angry. And next day I asked the class, why did you laugh? They, of course, were embarrassed. But they said, I said, this is important to me. I must find out how, in the highest moment of this day, you could laugh. I said, take it over. Please take this very seriously. I must know it. And they came back the next day after some consideration and they made a very fine statement, which I think was true. They said, we think we laughed because we felt that there were moments that this could never happen to us. We would never weep. You see, if you by your own will want to preclude certain potentialities in your own existence, you really pray God. And so you deprive yourself of your creative faculty. Creation cannot take place as long as your own will enters anything you have to do. You see, it must be stronger than you yourself. When Dante meets Beatrice, is a great word in the book on the new love, is somebody stronger than I entered the scene. Vene aliquis fortior me. Somebody came upon me who was stronger than me. And only the things that are stronger than we are the things that deserve to be done. Let us have a break. This explanation of this enterprise is also the explanation of why we have to have the Bible. That the past, before our emancipated world of church and state, that the past has to be conjured up to remind us of the intensity of living, of the singleness of purpose. Our era knows of unity of all men. But in order to have unity, the individual has to be given a share in various ways of life. The ancients had no such unity for all men, but they could keep everyone united on his specific way of life. As I said, once a baker, always a baker. All professionalism has this great dignity that the man is this and nothing else. To give you the Germans, who are very professional and very special, great specialists, excel in this dangerous habit of being one thing forever. And when I came to this country a year later, I was rang up at Harvard by a young man from Germany who said he had also left the country and could I help him to find a job. I said, he'd come over. He came, was very young, 23, and he said, what his interests were, and I said, well, I think the obvious thing for you is to become a chemist. I don't know why, what the circumstances were that made me say that. He said, I can't do that. I can't become a chemist. I said, why? I already have studied two terms of biology. So he had to become a biologist. You see? And that was all he could think of. He couldn't give up the 1 year in which he had become a specialist. This is very hard for you to understand because you learn everything, French and German, so for 1 year and then you give it up. With a German, once he begins to learn a thing for 1 year, he thinks he has to go on for another 50 years. With it. And that's an archaic type. But obviously your way of learning a language is very poor too. That you learn every one language for 2 or 3 years, then you ask, when I ask you, do you know German? You said, no, I learned this 3 years ago. And you imply that since you learned it 3 years ago, you no longer have any obligation to know one word of German. Isn't that true? I mean, that's what you call a language study. So the problem with you is to keep what you learn, and with the Germans is to learn a little more, something different at times. In other words, this is what I want you to store away for all these chapters which we are now going to live through. You must know of these people, not for curiosity's sake, not because they belong into the museum of prehistory, but because you and I will have to kindle our own flame of intensity of living. They develop one way of life, we who have to go on various ways of life must get some shot in the arm that, for example, you take these things which these people have established seriously. And so now let's turn to the first chapter. You see that with the empire that is very similar. We have lost much of the great faith and intensity of these people. We must stay out of their rut. We cannot go Egyptian and we cannot go Sioux. But the Sioux and the Egyptians and the Chinese and the Apaches have to offer us something terrific in the way of inspiration. Nothing of their specific way of life, you see, but everything in the power with which they have created this way of life. Now, what do we learn then in the first place from the old tribes, gentlemen? These tribes, how do they reach us today? Are in two ways, in three ways, perhaps. We speak in this country something that comes from the Anglo-Saxons, and the Angles and the Saxons were tribes. Long before they ever had a civilization, a city, they spoke. And we still speak their language. So they reach us today through the fact that they created a very wonderful language which we are very fast hacking to pieces. Which in a short time, if the Americans cling to basic English and other such nonsense, will no longer be a language, but just bricks with which we have slogans hitting each other over the head in headlines and whatnot. Really, you must feel, gentlemen, that language today is for the first time no longer handed over unimpoverished from father to son. You have not been taught English by your father. That's very serious. You are the first generation that has learned an impoverished English. Go to Pennsylvania and see how the Pennsylvania Dutch to this day speak 17th century English. And then you know that the children there have been taught English. You have not. Your father had no time for that. Mothers cannot teach you real English. They teach you the nursery rhymes. That's not English. That's the interior. That's the cheap English. That's for children. But the great language you may have learned in Sunday school, or you may have learned by learning by heart the Gettysburg Address. You haven't even read Coriolanus. So, how much Shakespeare has gotten into your vocabulary? And your father hasn't read you to you the Constitution of the United States, he hasn't made political speeches, he hasn't conveyed to you his creed, he has no time for that. He's supposedly busy all the time with making speeches. But by making speeches, you don't learn, the children don't learn a language convincingly. When your father would have cried in agony to his creator on his knees, you would have known why we speak, for example. Or if you had seen him contract with a friend on a serious deal, instead of just going to a lawyer in his office and not taking you with him, then you would have known what the language of the law is, how dignified it is, how important, how rich. Do you know the language of the law, of the common law? Do you know the language of religion? Do you know any of these words? As I said, when you say state and church, it never dawns on you that you are state and church. You think they are somewhere. So you haven't, your father, it would have been his duty to tell you that you are state and you are church. And that there is no other state and no other church except in you. Now, who has been told this by his father? May I ask? By his father. So, gentlemen, speech of the tribes will be one serious consideration because we are going to lose it. The second thing is, what do we know of these prehistoric tribes, gentlemen? What do the excavators excavate, usually? Will you tell me? Where do they go to find traces of the cavemen? What do they find? By which means do these people still make themselves known to us that they have lived 7,000 years ago? We?
Thanks.
Well, but where do we find these things?
Habitation.
Me?
Habitation.
Well, what kind of buildings? The tribesmen. They had no palaces, they had no pyramids, they had no settlements. They were nomads. Think, how, if you want to find anything, any trace of the Mongolian tribe who now sit in the center of Brazil and probably came across the Bering Strait and went through all of Asia before they passed over, how do we know anything of their ancestry? Well, you all know it, of course. What do we excavate? Tombs. Graves. Isn't that true? Now, gentlemen, it's very strange. These poor people, as you think, who couldn't write and read, had one way of reaching us over a thousand of years, by burying the dead. Whether they thought of us or not, they certainly did not know how we would look and who we would be. They instinctively found one way of telling us who they were, by burying the dead, by writing into the earth the story of their life. Because in this grave we find everything they use. Everything, you see. It's there. Horses, their bones, weapons, amulets, little babies, toys. So, gentlemen, the graves of the tribes are something that must make us meditate why people bury the dead. Again, I mean it, gentlemen, with my whole heart. You may laugh when I say that speech is no longer reaching your generation in its full power, but only as a trickle. The same is true about funerals. I have a friend who is a minister in this state, and he was out in Saipan as a chaplain of the army. And he and another chaplain, two good Christian gentlemen, took a stroll, and they found three naked Japanese bodies lying there in the field, killed by us. And they stared at these bodies and went home again. And he told me the story. And I gave him a sleepless night because I said, you think you are a minister of the gospel. You think you have the right to preach God's word. And you have not known that the first duty of any human being is to bury the dead. Oh, but that was the Japanese. So here he was his own judge. But this was a Japanese. This could not have happened with any wild man in the past. Because, gentlemen, why these people felt that they entered history by graves is the thing we have to explore. Mr. Sartre, you have heard of this interesting preposterous writer called Sartre in France, the existentialist, have you? Who has not heard of it? The others know him because he is allegedly so obscene, you know. But that's not all. He has written a very serious play, Les Morts sans Sépulture. Can you translate this? Si? Les Morts sans Sépulture.
Yeah.
Now that coincides with my story of my friend the chaplain. He didn't bury the dead, and Mr. Sartre writes a play on the fact that this we live in a time in which the dead are not buried. That's not a mere coincidence. That's the truth. The dead die out of sight. Who has seen an older member of his family die? Well, I'm glad that it still exists. It's nothing to laugh, sir. That's very serious. These are the great experiences of life. If you haven't seen a child born, or your father or your mother, they are dying, you have missed something. If you allow your wife to bear a child without your being present, you deserve it. That's not a business for doctors and midwives. It's for you.
Because there you reach the ultimate extreme opposite from your love for your wife, and you see an agony. And if you can't stand that, you are weakling. And she will always resent it without knowing that she resents it. You see, you can do nothing more effectively to assure a woman of your real devotion as your, her husband and not as her lover than you stand by at this very hour. But our doctors have prevented you from this. You have to force your way in. You have to be there. This is very serious, gentlemen, for your married life. Why do we have all these divorces? Because people only want to have fun together. I mean, either one of them has a misfortune, the businessman doesn't tell his wife and then has to shoot himself instead, and the wife is put in a coma. And that's life, married life. That means that they are one body, doesn't it? For better or for worse. Always only for better in this country, never for worse. These old ancient people knew that life in history begins with when the living set eyes on the dying person and the dying person sets eyes on the living. That is the strongest tie between the generations, as it is the strongest tie between you and your wife when you see that she braves the great danger of death, because any birth is entails this danger for the body that gives birth to the new life. You cannot have life without death, gentlemen, and you cannot have future without past. And you receive your future when you are present, when your ancestors die. And you can't say, as the people here in this town now usually say, it is indecent for a person to die at home. I have heard people say this twice in my presence. This man had the indecency to die in his own home. He didn't go to work. And they meant it. They meant it. They are absolute brutal barbarians today. Anybody who can say this is, of course, just as bad as my chaplain friend who didn't bury the Japanese. No relation to the honor and the dignity of dying. You will have to cope with all this in your own family, you see. Why do we have the racket of the undertaker? Because you don't know what to do with death. You would save $1,000 at each funeral if you would know how to behave yourself in this case. And you would have a wooden coffin of 6 boards and not one of these elaborate idiotic things with which the undertaker tries to bribe you to show your affection for the dead. Don't you think you show more affection when you prevent your people to die in a hospital, in a cold hospital bed, instead of dying at home, and then pay nothing for the funeral? But instead, you allow them to be shipped out into the hospital, which costs a lot of money anyway, you see, out of sight, and then comes the undertaker with an onion and says, spend $1,200 on the coffin. And you pay it, because you have, that's conscience money. You have to do something for the dead when it makes no sense anymore. This is going on in this country all the time. The minister gets 15% and the undertaker gets the rest. And the debts are with the widow. Now, who is equipped to say, I saw the soul of my father or my mother depart, therefore you undertaker, get out, Satan. I have I have a clear conscience. Everything has been done between us in life, therefore what happens to his body has to be done in the simplest terms, and 6 boards of oak or pine are just right. Isn't that simple? But who has the authority? You see, only a person who has been present at the beloved's death, because he's ahead of the undertaker. Gentlemen, the ancients invented history by burying the dead. We shall see that repeat in another chapter. And the third thing, of course, they invented the family. They invented the fact that children must have parents, and parents must have children, and they must call each other mutually by their rank and title. So speech, language has been created, funerals have been introduced, and
the family has been instituted. In the first thousand years of human history on this earth. And you will admit that the family and that language and that the relation between the past and the future are still our great topic of conversation today. That's why it is important, I think, to nourish one's own courage to do these things right by looking into their story. There have been as many tribes as this tree of the languages in the Darkness Hall hints at. As I said, we have reason to believe there are at this moment 9,025 languages counted in Africa alone. There are in Europe, of course, only perhaps 40, 50 languages spoken. In this country and in South America, if you do not count in the Indian languages, there's just Spanish, Portuguese, English, French, which is really dominant. I mean, then there is Yiddish and Polish and Italian, but they do not claim the literary existence, and they are all, so to speak, on the way out. The second, third generation is probably not going to cling to it. So you see, we live today on this continent with four languages. Would you? Is there any other which you I should mention? I may be wrong. Is there more than four?
Well, the fact that many of the radios and newspapers in the small and bigger cities still carry many more languages, I think. So there's still Italian spoken.
Well, I have no question. Any number will go. I'm just interested to state that in Africa you have 9,000. Because Africa is still a purely tribal continent, you see, of prehistoric character. Whereas we, who have passed through the church and state history, you see, and the union of the world, have already reduced these numbers to a tremendous extent. You see, this is quite interesting, the contrast, isn't it? 40 languages in Europe, 4 languages in America, 9,000 languages in Africa. This is quite important, just as a useful example to see what has been done. If then I use now examples, you must understand that all the tribes have the same principle of formation, although they have many varieties and diversities. For example, you have 10 tribes that are monogamous, and you have one tribe that is has the superiority of the woman, and she is allowed to have more than one husband. This is an experiment which one tribe made. And you must understand that the main creation of the tribe is identical in all the cases despite all the variations. This is important because this explains why it is not necessary to tell you the story of all the 100,000 tribes. You understand? The tribe is a group from 200 to 5,000 people. That is largest size possible, because it must be able to get the warriors of the tribe together in one spot. Without the meeting, we would say today the town meeting, or without the meeting of the whole tribe at any one spot, no tribe. But it is an occasional meeting. That is, the tribe has to meet once upon a time, but not always. The tribe consists then of small families drawing together at tribal meetings and then dispersing again. And the tribal meeting is the time and place where the families are created, where the people learn how to speak, and where the dead are treated as living. In the tribal meeting, you have then the three approaches which we have to undertake: the creation of language, the relation to the dead, and the founding of families. These three acts, however, are sporadic. The tribe cannot eat and fish and live in one place. But these people, as soon as possible, already for fear of famine, disperse. And the little group created in the tribe, the family, husband and wife and children, and perhaps an unmarried sister or brother and so, go off and try to make a living as best as they can. So the tribe is in a constant polarity, gentlemen, between the small group and the total group. Without this, you have no picture of the tribe. That there's a constant coming and going between the central meeting, you see, or the festivals, you can also say, you see, you know something of these dancing festivals, and these dispersals. The dispersal is the economy of the tribe. And the union is a policy of the tribe, the politics of the tribe. And the economy and the politics are related in such a way that the politics is a large unit and the economic is a small unit. We'll see that there's a difference in the empire. We'll see there that the economy is a big unit. But in the tribe, the economy is a house husbandry. Husband and wife husband their resources together. As I said, when they have their grown-up children with them, and the children may already have children again, then it is the grandfather, parents, you see, with all their children and the clan, as you still find it in the Philippines, for example, very decidedly so, and other many places, of course. But what I want you to really read in the books is the dynamism of a tribe. They describe all these things in the book, but they never show you that there's a constant dynamism between the political meeting where speech, ancestors, marriage is celebrated, and the economic hunt, fish, etc., where small parties go. You may have a raiding party of more than one family, but then it would just be the addition of two, three, four families banding together. It would not interfere with the political decision of the total group, which calls itself the Sioux or the Apache. And only one occasion at which the whole tribe moves right from the central meeting into the world, that's the war path. There is, on the war path, the whole tribe sticks together. But that, as you can see, is something unnatural, because the war path is a defense of the tribe against other tribes. That's not given in nature, that's in history. The war path leads the people of one tribe into the exposure, the competitive exposure to the forces, abilities of another tribe. Man is this strange animal, gentlemen, that has made war from the very beginning of time. And if you want to be cured from pacifism, study the tribes. It has been as much a tragedy for the tribes to have to go to war as it is for us. And there have been many diversifications. There have been tribes, gentlemen, who have tried to become pacifists. For example, the Eskimos. There is people who try to get out. You see, get into a place and forbear with everything, even with an igloo, in order not to have to bear arms and to fight their neighbors. We have in the tribal layer of history all the movements of our own time. We have anti-alcoholics, and we have pacifists, and we have vegetarians, and we have all Christian Science and everything you want. That is, man has always tried every way out of his misery, you see, of war, for example, or famine. And I warn you, therefore, I have to say these things right ahead so that you do not think that I want to make the area of their history smaller than it is. It is a very wide area, and there have been in the tribal history these special groups, which you can compare to the modern sect. The tribes also had already their sectarians, their people who didn't want to have speech to create, or families to found, or especially not to go on a war. and who tried everything to get out of the whole problem of staying in history and carrying the whole armor of life. What makes, therefore, this problem of the archaeologists and the prehistorians rather complicated, which has confused men, because you find all kind of oddities in this tribal history. But the tribes which our anthropologists today describe for having, for example, peaceful ideas like the Tobrianders, you know, from Mr. Malinowski, you may have heard of these people who allegedly thought that the pig begot the next children. They, of course, just tease Mr. Malinowski. But you find all kinds of such ways out of the pressure of the full life. But you will also find, gentlemen, that these people, which the anthropologists today find because they were pacifists or vegetarians or had some sectarian attitude towards life, that they did not make history. We come from those tribes, obviously. You see, everyone in this room comes from tribesmen 7,000 years back who did not go pacifist, who did not go vegetarian, who did not become Eskimos, but who stayed in some strange way in the central stream of life. And therefore, what we discover now in these special forms are obviously the ramifications, the extremes of one way or other, who in one survived in their way, but they couldn't get on. They got any sect and any such special tribe, gentlemen, was unable to transcend his own form of life, to go on to anything further. All of you have heard so much about anthropology that I thought I had to make this remark beforehand to set your mind at rest. I'm fully aware of all these specialties, but that doesn't at all alter the fact that there is one and the same principle running through the whole, this whole first layer of several thousand years of human history. Thank you.